This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Our guest, the Irish actor Chris O'Dowd, was introduced to a large American audience through the film Bridesmaids, in which he co-starred as a police officer with a crush on Annie, played by Kristen Wiig.
I didn't know that you could be a cop here if you weren't a citizen.
You can't.
No.
No. No, you can't. But they made a special dispensation because I'm so tough and strong.
Oh, right.
And handsome.
Oh, okay.
O'Dowd is also known for his role in Girls as the finance guy who was briefly married to Jessa. His films include Cavalry, St. Vincent, This Is 40, and The Sapphires. He's been in several British TV series, including The IT Crowd. Last year, he earned a Tony nomination for his performance opposite James Franco in the Broadway revival of Mice and Men. He created and co-stars in the British TV comedy series Moon Boy, which is shot in his hometown in Ireland and is based on his memories of growing up there. The third season was recently released on Hulu. We spoke 1 year ago. Chris O'Dowd, welcome to Fresh Air. So I want to play a clip from the first episode of Moon Boy. And so, you know, the bullies have been, like, picking on him. And then, you know, the 12-year-old Martin gets a gift from his parents. And it's the gift he's most wanted. It's a brand new bicycle. And the first time he takes it out, the bullies find him and they absolutely destroy the bike. And Martin goes home. He doesn't really want to tell his parents what happened because he's so embarrassed. But his parents figure it out. And his father decides to go to the bully's home and have a talk with the bully's father. The bullies are brothers. In case he needs a weapon, he puts a hammer in his pocket. And the father, you know, Martin's father is a kind of, you know, mild-mannered, get-along kind of guy. But mm-hmm. but he's got the hammer in his pocket. And he goes to the bully's house, rings the bell, and the father comes out. And here's the father speaking first.
Hello there.
Are you Mr. Bonner?
Jerry Bonner, yes, indeed.
Right. Well, my name is Liam Moon.
Hello, Lee Moon.
Hello. Now, listen. My son goes to school with your boys, and they...
Oh, no, they're awful, aren't they?
Sorry?
I mean, I love them, of course I do, but they're awful. Let me guess now, you come over here today because Connor and Johnner have done something rotten to your boy, am I right?
They broke his new bicycle.
Oh, they're awful bullies. I'm so sorry. Is he okay?
Yeah, well, he's a bit shaken up, yeah.
Of course he is, the poor lad. I don't know what to do with them anymore. I mean, you probably come over here now expecting me to be some horrible, angry brute who bullies his kids, who in turn go out and bully other kids. Am I right?
Well, kinda, yeah.
Well, I'm not. I'm a good person.
You seem like a good person.
Thank you. You seem like a good person, too.
Thank you.
God, I hate my kids.
I'm not too crazy about my own.
They're awful, aren't they, children? I mean, here we are, two decent fellas full of compassion and willingness to love. And what do we get in return to you?
Hassle.
You know. Listen, there's nobody in at the minute. Do you want to come in for a quick cup of tea?
Well, I don't know.
You're the look of a man who wants a cup of tea, no? Huh?
All right, then.
Good man. Is there a hammer in your pocket? Let me guess. You were planning to beat me to death with it, weren't you?
I was indeed.
Bloody kid.
Ah!
Did I say tea? I meant gin.
And that's Unchained Melody playing in the background, which is funny, like they're falling in love.
Whenever we're in the edit for the show, the producer is always pulling his hair out because I'm always asking for panpipe versions of songs.
So I really like the father in this. And so much of the contemporary Irish literature that comes to the U.S. has this like abusive or alcoholic mm-hmm. or totally absent father. And the fathers in your show, they're like, they're responsible, they're intimidated by their own children. Who is the father? Who is Martin's father based on in this? Was your father like that?
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, he's very sensitive. He actually came to see Of Mice and Men the other night, and they flew over from Ireland. And the tears, I mean, he's a very sensitive soul. And most of the men that I do know are very sensitive. And I do like exploiting that for humor. Essentially what happens after that scene is they join a group of men called Men's Anonymous, which is essentially just men who hate their kids. And they all get together once a week and pretend to play poker, even though none of them know how to play poker, and try and do some kind of new agey talks like, be dad, not sad.
Do you think your father was intimidated by you and your siblings?
It was a very maternal house. So, or a very matriarchal house, I suppose. It was. I had three sisters. It's incredibly close to the show. My father is a sign writer, like the guy in the show. And my mother was a Weight Watchers instructor, as my mother was at the time. And I have three older sisters. So I feel like he definitely felt out of place as a man.
Did you feel out of place as a boy?
I like to think that it was how I learned the mysterious ways of the woman.
Well, Martin is learning the mysterious ways of women. He's 12, puberty is starting, and, you know, he's just starting to have what we would call in broadcasting nocturnal emissions. And he's terrified about what he's been finding on his sheets in the morning. He's been hiding the sheets. And his parents figure, well, it's time to have a talk with him about the facts of life. And his mother's dealt with it with his older sisters, but now it's his father's turn to deal with it with Martin. So in this scene, Martin's father and mother are seated side by side, and they've just called in Martin for the big discussion.
What's happening is perfectly natural. Listen to me.
But I'm sleepy.
Women. Men. What's it all about? Huh? Who knows? Well, you don't know. That's why we're doing this. So, girls are essentially creatures of the night. They're fascinating and alluring. And take your mother here.
Please don't.
Birds. Bees. Another winged creature.
But I'm sleepy too.
Penises. Vaginas.
Marty, do you want to come busking in town, buddy?
Do I?
That was something. Not quite as intense as me explaining periods to Sinead, but close.
What do you mean the moon's going to make me bleed? I'll make the moon bleed!
The father is obviously so uncomfortable in this conversation. And that was the uncle coming in and interrupting midway and asking the kid to come out busking with him and relieving the tension of the conversation. Do you remember what it was like when your father sat you down to tell you the facts of life, or was that not necessary? Did you already know them?
I think it was a mixture of both. And I don't think, looking back, it was my father at all. I think my mum did it. And I think it was, she did it a little too late, where I still felt compelled to listen to it, but I knew a lot of it. So essentially then you're just a 12-year-old talking to your mother about sex.
That's not a good recipe, right?
No, it's terribly awkward. There's nothing worse.
What did you find most baffling about your sisters, your older sisters, when you were young?
The moods. The moods were something. And the violence.
Violence?
We all get on very, very, very well. But at that age, when we didn't have an awful lot of money, so it was we were sharing a room, and for fun, one of them would hold me down, and the other one would tickle me until I was laughing, and the other would spit in my mouth.
Ugh.
And I know it's grim, Terry. I'm not painting a beautiful picture, but this is I'm going for honesty.
In Moon Boy, your TV series that's on Hulu, your surrogate Martin, your autobiographical character, Martin, when he's a boy, his older sisters put makeup on him while he's sleeping, and he's such a rush to get to school because he's always late. He's not washing his face. He's not looking in the mirror. And so he shows up with makeup on his face, and everybody's kind of doing the ooh-la-la thing to him, and he has no idea why. Is that something that happened to you? Did your sisters?
Yeah, that one did happen to me. My sister would put makeup on me, and then essentially when you're the youngest of five, it's often left to some of the elder siblings to have parental duties, like waking the young kids up in the morning. And so they would deliberately wake me up really late, so I didn't have time to wash or anything. And then when I got to school, there would be some laughing and snickering, and I would run into the toilet and find that I'd been given smoky eye or some blusher in during my sleep. And when they were being particularly cruel, they would make it very subtle, so it looked like it was a choice I was making.
So this happened more than once, I take it?
I think this happened 3 times to me.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's—I think it's character building. I don't know.
Describe the character of Morton.
Well, he's an idiot. I mean, if I'm honest, what I like about our show is that I find that kids on television are often precocious, and they always seem to be teaching the parents something by the end of the episode. And that is not my experience of kids. Most kids I know are dumb, and my nieces and nephews have never taught me anything other than how to find my keys when they've hidden them somewhere. Essentially, it's a very semi-autobiographical show. The kid is really me growing up. It's in my hometown. We shoot some of it in my mum's house. And he has an imaginary friend who I play in the show.
Did you have an imaginary friend when you were growing up?
I actually didn't. It's the one part of the show that is completely fictitious. I like to say, I'm the youngest of 5 kids. And I like to think that there just wasn't room in the house for an imaginary friend.
not your size. But,
no.
But you know, I keep wondering, watching it, like, would a 12-year-old kid have an adult as an imaginary friend, or another kid, or maybe an animal?
Well, this is part of the thing. He's a very unimaginative kid. Like, some of his other friends have wrestlers and dogs and fairy god princes and things as an imaginary friend. And his imaginary friend is a mid-level insurance salesman with the most common name in Ireland. His name is Sean Murphy. And he essentially is, without looking too deeply into it, he essentially is the personification of how he imagines himself in 20 years' time. So he doesn't have very lofty ambitions for himself either.
So you mentioned that you had you have 4 siblings, and you grew up with 3 older sisters. Who was the 4th sibling?
Oh, then there's my older brother, who's 10 years older than me, who I didn't put in the show because at that age he was gone. So I didn't really have anything for him to do in the show, if that makes sense.
Right.
He would have been just too old. He's actually in the TV show, though. He's an actor as well. And he plays one of the dads in that scene, the Dad's Anonymous.
So in your series, I guess, is it one of the sisters? I think that's maybe one of the sisters says to Martin, the main character, the 12-year-old, that he was a mistake. I mean,
right.
An accident is what she says.
That's right.
So do you think you were an accident?
Every Irish kid is an accident. There's I remember asking my mother about that, because that was another thing that came out. Essentially, what she says in that scene is the sister says to Martin, Mom says that you were a mistake. And Martin looks really sad. And I say to him, listen, don't worry, buddy. You weren't a mistake. You were an accident. And I remember my sister saying that to me when I was around that age. And I went to my mom years later and I said, listen, Mom, I want to get to the bottom of this. Like, I'm happy with the way that things have worked out. You know, we have a great relationship and I love you terribly. But was I an accident? And she said, you were all accidents. It was the 70s. Which actually made me feel much better, bizarrely.
Moon Boy is shot in your hometown in Ireland. Are many of the people who were there when you were growing up still there?
A bunch of them, yeah. And it's a bizarre experience kind of filming. And it's a very small town, maybe 1,500, 2,000 people. So I kind of know everybody there, really, other anybody over the age of 20. And so it's lovely kind of filming on the streets and having people coming up and not necessarily knowing the way that filming works. They just kind of walk up and say, oh, hey, and start passing the time of day while you're in the middle of a scene. And it feels very horrible to go, oh, I can't actually talk. I'm working right now. It feels very fake because there are all these streets that I've been walking on since I was a babogue.
Do some of those people hate you now because maybe they don't like the way the town and the people are depicted in Moon Boy?
I honestly haven't had anything but good feedback from it. I think it's a very loving look at it. I'm not trying to poke fun at small town life, or I do think it's a very fair depiction of it and a very loving depiction of it. And I tried to shoot it in a way that it looks nice as well. So I feel people seem to really, really enjoy it. That's the impression I get anyway. I'm sure behind my back it's very much otherwise.
Now, you had a part in the Christopher Guest mockumentary series Family Tree. And I know that you found out that your great-grandfather was a bigamist. I don't think that revelation had anything to do with being in this mockumentary about genealogy. But how did you find that out, and how did that change your conception of what your family was?
Well, I think I found out through somebody drunkenly telling me in a pub that a person that probably had been sworn to secrecy about it. And it didn't change. It didn't really change the way I thought about my family at all. If anything, it made it feel more interesting. The show, the Family Tree show, was essentially a parody of Who Do You Think You Are? And at the time, I would get asked a lot if I'd like to go and do the show, Who Do You Think You Are? It's like celebrities and whoever go into their lives, they essentially look at their family tree. And they go off and they discovered that their great-grandmother lost a child, and the child that survived was their great-grandfather, and then there's loads of tears. They'll end up in Serbia, where their ancestors used to live, and all of these kind of things. And they're particularly because America is such a relatively new country, the tree would expand into the furthest corners of the world. But when I started looking into mine, I found that the very first O'Dowds are from 20 minutes from where we live now. So I could never really do that. Would be the worst television. You know, yeah, your great-great-grandfather is just sitting over there. rather than he was a fiddle player in Vietnam.
So it was kind of exhilarating to find out that your great-grandfather had a secret life.
I'm glad that somebody got out.
It sounds like you're glad you got out. Yeah. But you went back. You went back to shoot there, so you're there and not there.
I did. It's just it's the gift that keeps on giving.
So one of the economic centers of the town that you grew up in was a call center, which I believe you worked at for a while before becoming an actor.
That's not quite right. I worked at a call center for sure, but that was when I was living in London.
Oh, okay.
I worked at a call center for different charities. So essentially we would be calling up people who had subscriptions to whichever charity and asking them to increase it. And this is pretty terrible. But I worked for a very famous wildlife charity for quite a while. And we would call up people and tell them that different species were being eliminated and becoming extinct, and we were trying to raise funds to protect them from that. But very often these species would be like bats and like newts. And I would call up and I'd say, oh, this bat in Papua New Guinea is going to become extinct. And the person on the other end of the phone would be like, great, that sounds like a pain. I'm delighted. You want some extra bullets? Is that what we're paying for? No. This newt in, you know, New Zealand. Oh, good, good. Who wants newts? So eventually, to get any money, oh, this is bad. I would start, I would make up endangered species. So that seemed more palatable.
Oh, what's some of the names that you'd make up?
the one that was most successful is I told people from maybe 2 months up and down England that the tiger swan was in danger. The tiger swan was essentially a swan with the markings of a Bengal. You can visualize that in your head. And I would tell people this, and they would say, I've just never heard of it. And I'd be like, well, it's endangered. You know, if it was common, I wouldn't be calling. So yeah, it was the tiger swan. There was some kind of a flying dolphin or something, but like oh, a flying salmon. It was not like actually in the air, but like, oh yeah, it was poor behavior. But we made quite a lot of money. So a lot of newts were saved.
I'm going to ask you about the movie that made you famous in the United States, and that's Bridesmaids, your breakthrough role here in the U.S. And this is a Judd Apatow-produced film. Why don't we start with a scene? Because people who've seen the movie will certainly remember this scene. So Kristen Wiig plays Annie, the bride's best friend and maid of honor, but the wedding's creating a lot of friction between them. And the Kristen Wiig character, Annie, has started to go out with your character, a police officer named Officer Rhodes, and they met after he pulled her over because her taillights were out, and he agreed to tear up the ticket if she agreed to get the lights fixed, which she didn't do. And then they spend the night together, but after that, she kind of freaks out and rejects him, so he's very hurt. And in this scene, Annie's just had a huge fight with her friend at the friend's bridal shower. And while driving home, she totals her car, she needs a tow truck, and you come by in your official capacity as a cop. And as you're talking a little later in the scene, John Hamm drives up in his sports car to pick her up. So you speak first in this scene.
Do you have any idea how frustrating it is to see you night by night drive past me with your taillight still broken? Do you have any idea how crazy that makes me? It's a simple solution. Your problem, Annie, is that you just don't understand that you can hurt people with these broken lights. Don't you see how irresponsible this is?
Yes, I should have gotten my taillights fixed, but I didn't, okay? I didn't.
Listen, don't worry about it. Seriously, your message was received.
No, look, please, I don't know what's going on with me right now.
Look, it's fine, don't bother. No. Really, it's... what's done is done.
Wait, that's it? Where are you going?
That's it. That's how this works.
Well, come on, I didn't...
For the record, Annie, you flirted with me. You made me feel like you really liked me, which was really unfair. And then you came home with me and we did stuff, fun stuff, and then you just left. It's like it was nothing.
Oh, please. I know how guys do this thing. I know how guys act. One minute it means something, the next minute it doesn't.
Oh, right, yeah, you've got it all figured out.
Yeah.
How's that working out for you? Pretty good? Boom!
What's up, buddy? Call for some roadside assistance? Thanks, officer. I can handle it from here on out.
Come on!
And that's John Hamm driving up at the end of that scene. So you're such a really sympathetic character in this film. How did you get the part?
I auditioned. I went in. Paul Feig, the director, had known some of my stuff. I did a sitcom in Britain called The IT Crowd, and he had been a fan of that. So I got in to the room, and I improvised with Kristen for maybe 45 minutes. And we just had a really good time. And I kind of went in, not necessarily, I didn't have a name or anything like that. And it was going to be a very hard get. So I didn't go in with much expectation. I just really enjoyed myself. And thankfully it all worked out all right.
Let's talk about your role in Girls. And this was in the first season. And you played a finance guy named Thomas John, one of the few guys who made a fortune on the recession. And you meet Jessa and Marnie at a club. You buy them a drink and then invite them home. And your character's really excited at the prospect of a three-way. That's what he's really hoping for, which is what Jessa and Marnie kind of lead him to believe is going to happen because they start kissing each other, but they won't let him kiss them. And as he grows more frustrated, Marnie knocks over a drink on his very expensive rug, and then he just kind of blows up in frustration. Here you are.
Do you even know what it's like to work hard?
No, tell us.
I've been under a lot of pressure my whole life to succeed. Daddy didn't buy me this rug or this apartment or this nose. That's not your nose. There's no way that's your nose. There's no cartilage in the world that exquisite. So it kind of ticks me off when I come to Williamsburg after working hard all day in the real world and I see all these stupid little daddy's girls with their bowler hats. What are you doing with bowler hats, stupid? And then you come over
and you flirt and flirt and flirt and flirt and kiss and kiss, and listen to my amazing tunes, drink my beautiful wine, and then spill it all over my gorgeous rug and laugh about it.
Yeah, well, we're not laughing at your rug, trust
me.
We're
not laughing. You don't hurt us.
We're laughing at your mash-ins.
Mash-ups!
That's my guest, Chris O'Dowd, in an episode of Girls. And you end up marrying Jessup. You end up being a really pretty sympathetic character, because at first you seem like a real jerk, but you're kind of insecure. You want to love and be loved, and yeah, like I say, ended up being more likable than you initially seemed to be.
Yeah, I mean, that was one of those. I was surprised to get asked back. I kind of. I had met Lena, and she asked me to come and do an episode. And
Lena Dunham, the creator.
Sorry, Lena Dunham, who makes the show. And so I went and did that, which is that kind of the episode where that scene that you just heard. And I presumed that that would be that. And then she asked me to come back, and I was kind of reluctant because I was like, what else can you do with that character, really? He's just such a douche. She's like, oh, I want him to marry one of the girls. I thought she was joking, if I'm honest. But I think she was right. They had to probably make him a bit more sympathetic, because otherwise it's just he's just a guy ranting for, you know, 3 or 4 episodes.
So there's another scene that I want to play, and this is from This Is 40. And just in case it's not clear, Bridesmaids was produced by Judd Apatow. Girls is produced by Judd Apatow. And This Is 40 was produced and directed and written by by Judd Apatow.
I owe that guy a drink.
Yeah, honestly.
Yeah.
So in This Is 40, Paul Rudd is the star, and he plays a character who's has this like fledgling indie record label, which is specializing in retro rock. And in order to stay in business, he needs an album that's actually going to sell some copies. And so he's invested all of his hopes and his money in an album intended to revive rocker Graham Parker's career. And you're skeptical that anyone is going to be interested. And Lena Dunham also plays someone who works at the company, and she's handling some of the publicity for the album. And she's just produced a promotional video which features archival footage of Graham Parker along with current footage and current interviews. And you do not like this video. You speak first.
What are you doing?
I'm contextualizing him as one of the great figures in rock history.
You can't show him in his prime in 77 and then jump straight to him as he is now. It's terrifying. You got to reverse it. You got to show him as he is now very briefly and then show him in 1977. You got to Benjamin Button it.
I know what you're talking about, okay? All rock stars are older now. Steven Tyler, David Bowie, Mick Jagger.
Paul McCartney.
Okay, stop it.
Paul
Everybody McCartney. That you are mentioning looks like an old woman now. You're just mentioning a bunch of Jessica Tandys. Keith Richards gets away with it. But that's because Keith Richards looked 70 when he was 40. And now that he's 70, he looks 69. He's regenerating.
So that's my guest Chris O'Dowd in a scene from the Judd Apatow film This Is 40. Since you've worked on several Judd Apatow projects and you were directed by him on this, what have you learned from him?
Quite a lot. He's incredibly smart, but also very, very well prepared. And the way that he'll do things is he talks to you during the take. So he'll have maybe 5 or 6 really funny lines up his sleeve if he feels like the one that he's written isn't working. And I guess what you learn from that is just don't be too precious about what you've written on the page yourself.
So when you say he's feeding you lines, as he's talking to you as you're shooting, is he talking to you on a hidden earphone, or is he actually...
No, he's just shouting from a seat.
How come we're not hearing it on mic?
Well, he'll say whatever he's saying, and then I'll go, okay, cool, I'll try that.
So do you remember any lines from the scene we just heard that he told you to say as you were shooting?
I say the line there, you got a Benjamin Button that.
Yes. Yeah.
That very much sounds like a Judd line. And I'm sure the Keith Richards thing about him regenerating, he looked 70 when he was 40, definitely sounds, because I can't remember it being in the script either. It's the same with the girls clip. I find it hard to remember what was in the script, what I came up with on the day or what they came up with on the day. And I kind of like that about it. I never feel when I do loads of improv in a scene and it doesn't make it, I'm never hurt by that because I can barely remember doing it afterwards.
So if you don't mind me bringing this up, you had a part in the movie Gulliver, which I did not see, the one starring Jack Black, you know, the remake.
You were not alone, Terry.
Yes, I know. That was an expensive film that, you know, very few people saw. Did you have a sense when you were making it that, you know, either it wasn't good or it was going to be a flop? And if so, what's it like to want to give your all, but to at the same time know that it's not going to be a great work of art?
Yeah, it's tricky. I mean, to be honest, when you're starting your career out, you don't mind so much. And you don't know that things aren't going to be great because there's so many great people involved. You presume, oh, they're going to fix this at some stage and by magic or something. You don't know. And you're having such a good time at the time, you just try and do your job. And that happens still, you know. I'm still involved with projects sometimes where I'm like, I'm not 100% sure this has ever got to the place that we thought it was going to get to when we're shooting it. And it's difficult because there's obviously a reason that that's the case. Either the director or the star or whoever just has a different vision of it than you do. And it's okay to fail sometimes. That's how art works.